I was telling Randy on the way in that last night, Noah, for some reason, had set his alarm so he could make sure he wake up this morning. And at 11:25, it went off, and 11:25, it went off again. Finally went in there, clicked it off. I said, "What was that all about?" He said, "I don't know." So it was a little bit of a rough night, no nap. So if I fall asleep, somebody come up here, finish my notes, and we'll carry on. Don't worry about it. Well, it's truly a pleasure to see everybody here tonight. And hopefully this lesson that I prepared, I was kind of torn between two that I've been considering. And hopefully I picked the right one and that this lesson will be beneficial to all of us. And that I present it in a way, as Dave said, that is clear and understandable. Sometimes what is clear and understandable in my head may not be clear and understandable in yours. So that's generally in my presentation. But anyway, I truly look forward to presenting God's Word. The other thing is, no excuse, but allergy season is upon us, and I'm hoping I don't sneeze and cough too much tonight. Okay, so one of the great things, amongst the many wonderful great things, about living out in the country is that we get to enjoy nature on and around the ranch. I love it. For you that live in Sparks, sorry, I like it better out there. But we get to see deer grazing up on the hillsides, which is always fun. The boys get out there with the binoculars and the telescope and looking for horns all the time. One time last year, Noah and I stalked this little buck just to see how close we could get and had a little bit of fun with that. And we got pretty close. We were under 100 yards a couple times. We get geese down in the pasture. Sarah says they're always laughing at you. Ha ha, you can't hunt us here, right? We'll see about that. We also have a couple of hawks building a nest in a tree. And last weekend we were out working on the garden and these things were coming in low and just hanging in the breeze. It was really neat to see. Noah especially was really excited about it. And it's really neat to watch these two hawks build this nest up there. I don't know how excited our chickens are going to be about the hawks being there when we finally get the chicken coop in, but we may have to deal with that. And right now, out there we're building what has been named and dubbed the Veg Mahal. Right? It's not the Taj Mahal, it's the Veg Mahal. It's a 24 by 35 foot garden area. Hopefully, Lord willing, we'll have a forest of vegetables to enjoy and share God's bounty. One other thing that the kids really like to do, and they did it a couple times last year, is they go out and look on all the milkweed plants and they find the little monarch butterfly caterpillars. And what they'll do is they'll catch them, and Sarah and the kids will pick a bunch of milkweed leaves and whatnot and put them in a quart mason jar, put the caterpillar in there, put a coffee filter over the top so it can still breathe, and put a lid on it. And they'll watch this thing. They're entertained for a couple weeks as this caterpillar kind of cruises around the jar. He runs up and down and around, and he's eating all the leaves, and he's getting fatter, right? He's getting bigger, he's getting fatter, putting on some weight. Before long, this caterpillar wraps itself up in a cocoon, and it's hanging there on a thread. And it begins that magical transformation from from a caterpillar into a butterfly. All right. Pretty soon that green cocoon gets darker and darker, and then it becomes transparent. You can actually see the orange and the black of the monarch butterfly's wings through it. Before long, that beautiful monarch butterfly emerges from its cocoon. Kind of stretches its wings out. It's got to dry them off. So then Sarah will take the kids and the butterfly out, and she'll let it go. And it kind of hangs around, walks around, keeps its wings spread out, testing them, drying them off, because it can't fly when its wings are wet. And then eventually it flies away. So then the transformation from this kind of ho-hum, little bit ugly, kind of creepy, weird-looking little caterpillar into a beautiful butterfly is complete. That brings us to the title of my lesson tonight. In a world of caterpillars, we are to be butterflies. If you would, turn with me over to Romans 12. Paul writes to the church at Rome there, beginning in verse 1, he says, I beseech you therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable to the Lord, which is your reasonable service. And do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God. Now what comes to your mind when you think about a sacrifice? For me, I think about those animals in the Old Testament. And one thing that you can't argue about those animals in the Old Testament is that they were all in, right? They left nothing that they had on the table. They gave all, not by choice, right? None of them wanted to go and be sacrificed, but they certainly gave it all. And that's what God's asking from us. He wants us to give it all. He wants us to leave nothing on the table. How? How does he want us to do this? Verse 2. Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed. So with my analogy, what he's saying is, do not behave in such a way that you look like a caterpillar, but that you look like a butterfly. Caterpillars down on the ground, crawling through the milkweeds and the dirt, but the butterflies are soaring above them. The butterflies have a higher calling, and so do we. We have a higher calling. There are certainly many, many, many examples of this throughout the Bible. And there are certainly a whole ton of them that I could use, but I'm going to ask you to indulge me tonight because I'm going to go to probably what has to be one of my favorite books in the Old Testament, certainly, and that's the book of Daniel. If you would, go ahead and start turning your Bibles over there. To Daniel 1. Now, Judah had been carried off into Babylonian captivity due to the evil and the idolatry that they had committed before God. What they were there for was their fault as a whole nation. There were those, the remnant, who strove to do God's will that were suffering the consequences of other people's actions. I believe that Daniel and his companions that we read about were amongst them. So let's go ahead and read, and that brings us up to where we're at. Daniel 1, verse 8. I'll wet my whistle before I read. It says, but Daniel purposed in his heart, let me go back, they're being trained. These young men are being trained in the king's court to serve, and they were being offered the delicacies and the wine which the king drank, which apparently for whatever reason they believed would defile them, whether it was foods that were prohibited by God or whatnot. Okay, so let's go verse 8. But Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with the portion of the king's delicacies, nor with the wine which he drank. Therefore he requested of the chief of the eunuchs that he might not defile himself. Now God had brought Daniel into the favor and goodwill of the chief of the eunuchs. And the chief of the eunuchs said to Daniel, I fear my lord the king, who has appointed your food and drink. For why should he see your faces looking worse than the young men who are your age? Then you would endanger my head before the king. So Daniel said to the steward, whom the chief of the eunuchs had set over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, please test your servants for 10 days, and let them give us vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then let our appearance be examined before you and the appearance of the young men who eat the portion of the king's delicacies, and as you see fit, so deal with your servants. So he consented with them in this matter and tested them 10 days. At the end of 10 days, their features appeared better and fatter in flesh than all the young men who ate the portion of the king's delicacies. Thus the steward took away their portion of delicacies and the wine that they were to drink and gave them vegetables. So Daniel and his companions here decided that despite the pressure to defile themselves with food that they were apparently not allowed to eat, they refuse it and they strike a deal with the steward to only eat the vegetables and drink water. There were other young men there who partook of the delicacies. They decided, for whatever reason, that they were going to go along with the program. But Daniel and his three friends went against the program and served God's way, as they did in a very difficult situation what God asked them to do. And after the 10 days, he tested them, and their appearance was certainly better than the other young men who were eating the delicacies. So let's go over now to Daniel 3. Again, a little background here because we're not going to read the whole thing. Nebuchadnezzar had set up a massive golden image upon the plains, and he commands all people to bow before it when music is played. Turn towards it and bow and worship this image. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego refuse, and they are brought before the king. All right, now imagine there's a group of, I don't know, we'll say 100 people cruising along. Music starts. 97 go down, and they're standing there going, nope, not doing it. This is why we're here in the first place, right? Idolatry is what put us here. We are not bowing down before this. So, because they refuse, they're brought before the king. Verse 13. Then Nebuchadnezzar, after being told that they refused to worship, in rage and fury, gave the command to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So they brought these men before the king. Nebuchadnezzar spoke, saying to them, is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the gold image which I have set up? Now, if you are ready at the time you hear the sound of the horn, flute, harp, lyre, and psaltery, and symphony with all kinds of music, and you fall down and worship the image which I have made, good. But if you do not worship, you shall be cast immediately into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you from my hands? He gave him a second chance. All right? Nebuchadnezzar probably saw some value in these men at some point. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If that is the case, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us from your hand. But if not, let it be known to you, O king, that we do not serve your gods, nor will we worship the golden image which you have set up. So they're telling him, our God can save us from you, and he will. But even if he doesn't, even if we die in this fiery furnace, I'm not worshiping you or your gods. That's just the way it is. So imagine the pressure that these young men felt. though, to conform to their new way of life. Tremendous amount of pressure. Here they are. They were taken from their homeland by force at arms. No choice in the matter whatsoever. It's not like they moved from one state to a new state to get a new job. Right? They did not move there by choice. They were moved there by force. They were separated from their families at a young age, probably early to mid-teens, is when these young men were yanked from their families and taken off into a strange land that, from timelines and accounts and whatnot, it looks like Daniel never went back because he served until Cyrus. He probably never went home. They're forced into service for a king who had a very, very short fuse. King Nebuchadnezzar, when his anger was aroused, people died. He had no regard for people who would stand against his will. Yet, they chose to stand firm in their faith and be so different from the people that were around him that they were actually an influence upon Nebuchadnezzar himself. At the end of his story, Nebuchadnezzar's story in the book of Daniel, he wrote something. Now, God had put him into kind of a delirium for 7 years, and he was eating grass, and he came to his senses, and he realized something. He says, in Daniel 4, verse 37, he says, "Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol and honor the King of heaven, all of whose works are truth and his ways justice, and those who walk in pride he is able to put down." He recognized the God of heaven and understood who he was. Then there's Daniel, after he was pulled from the lion's den. We're not going to read that story. I find it interesting that it's the time of Darius. This is a little side note. And we always see the pictures of him as this really young man in the lion's den. He was probably in his 80s or close to. This was way late in their captivity, right before they were brought out of captivity. So he was an old man then. But Daniel, after he was pulled from the lion's den, so influenced King Darius with his life that after he was pulled from the lion's den, Darius made a decree. It says to all peoples, chapter 6, verse 25 through 27. Then King Darius wrote, "To all peoples, nations, and languages that dwell in all the earth, peace be multiplied to you. I make a decree that is in every dominion, that in every dominion of my kingdom, men must tremble and fear before the God of Daniel. For he is the living God and steadfast forever. His kingdom is the one which shall not be destroyed, and his dominion shall endure to the end. He delivers and rescues, and he works signs and wonders in heaven and on earth, who has delivered Daniel from the power of the lions." Now these four men, by being transformed from who they were, at some point they did not have a relationship with God. Everybody hits that quote unquote age of accountability, right? Then they make the decision to worship God, to follow the traditions of their fathers. But by being transformed from who they were previously into God-fearing, obedient men, they influenced kings. They had an influence on Nebuchadnezzar and Darius. They saw the working power of God through these four men and came to an understanding who God was. I'm not saying that they worshiped God, so to speak, but they came to an understanding who God was. You know, you might be sitting there saying to yourself, "That's all well and good, but I will never influence kings." So what is our living sacrifice? Our living sacrifice is everyday life. You know, the history of Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and so many others where we see the power of God. I mean, we could look at Moses, we can look at the things that God did for Israel. It's so big and so spectacular that it may seem overwhelming to us, that we just sit and go, this is over the top. I don't know how I could do that. How does that apply to me? Right? It was just their everyday lives. Just different circumstances. No different than ours, but the circumstances. It was their everyday lives. Their everyday living sacrifice that they made to God. You know, have not been carried off into captivity like they were. But after their training period, what did they do? They went to work every day. That's what those four men did. They went and served the king's court every day, just like we do. We go to work every day, unless you're fortunate enough to be retired. Right? They may have had families to care for, just like we do. Everyday life. They interacted with people who did not believe in the God of heaven, just like we do. Every single day. You know, we're not in danger of a temperamental king being thrown into a fiery furnace or being tossed into a lion's den, but we face the same challenges they did. How to be a butterfly in a world full of caterpillars. You know, when you're at work, someone starts speaking ill of somebody. Do you join in? Do you fall right in line with the worst influence in your work environment and laugh and joke? Do you, when coarse jesting begins, do you participate? Because you want to fit in? Or do you, as Daniel did, refuse the king's delicacies and stand out? Do you follow Paul's instructions? Get over there in Colossians, verse 4, or Colossians chapter 4, sorry, verses 5 and 6, where he says, walk in wisdom towards those who are outside, redeeming the time. Let your speech always be with grace, seasoned with salt, that you may know how you ought to answer each one. Do you try to build people up instead of tearing them down, to build yourself up? You know, those who have accepted the higher calling should speak kindly of other people. Sometimes the things they do can be frustrating. I've been dealing with some new service advisors at work that are frustrating for me, and the things they do frustrate me. And I have to remember that they are people deserving of my kind speech. You know, Mike and I were just talking this morning about how the homosexual agenda seems to be worming its way into every single aspect of our lives. He went on a suicide prevention walk, and people would get different colored beads depending on what family member they had lost to suicide. And those that didn't have it, some of them had to get the rainbow effect, which is another irritant to me, that they have taken God's promise, symbol of God's promise, and turned it into meaning something vile, to be all inclusive. Right? They want access into whatever bathroom, locker room, and dressing room, depending on how they identify themselves that day, as whether male or female. I mean, imagine a male high school teacher having access to a girl's locker room because he identifies himself as female that day. and you can't do anything about it? Do you say, when discussions like that come up at work, that God sees homosexuality as abhorrent, or do you just say nothing at all? And frankly, any sin for that matter. When people joke about sexual misconduct, do you just, whatever. When people speak vilely, vulgar, do you just ignore it in one ear, out the other? We watch so many movies with it, we don't even hear it anymore. Or do you stand up and say, please don't speak to me that way. I choose not to speak that way. My God finds it offensive. You know, these four young men stood up against idolatry in Babylon because they realized something about themselves that applies to us also. If you would, turn over to 1 Peter chapter 2. You can read verses 9 and 10. Peter writes to them there, he says, but you are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, his own special people, that you may proclaim the praises of him who called you out of darkness and into his marvelous light, who were once not a people, but are now the people of God, who had not obtained mercy, but now have obtained mercy. Do we realize that this is us? We are God's royal priesthood. We are God's holy nation. Do we behave like we are? Do we behave when we walk outside here like we are God's holy nation? His royal priesthood proclaiming him to the world? Do the caterpillars see us as butterflies? Or do we just look like another caterpillar to them? The difference should be as obvious as a caterpillar and a butterfly. You cannot mistake one for the other. If you have not been baptized into Christ, then you will not receive the benefits of a relationship with God, the forgiveness of sins that he offered through his son, a hope of heaven after this life is over. And as Kyle's lesson this morning, we can see that can happen any given time. If you've not been baptized, we're prepared to baptize you tonight, put you into that relationship with God, if that's your wish. And if you wish to study further, if you don't fully understand, please come to somebody. We would be more than happy to study with you. Now, if you're a butterfly, and you've been struggling with the draw to transform yourself back into a caterpillar. That's one thing butterflies can't do, is turn back into caterpillars, but we can. That draw for us from the world can be very strong. If you've been struggling with that, we'd love to help you. We'd love to help pray for you. If you have any needs tonight, we ask that you come forward as we stand and sing.